sharing it. Right, I'm going to start off by telling you what astroseismology is, and one can draw a very close analogy with seismology here on Earth. We have a seismologist out in the field. So here's the Earth. Here's our seismologist. She's wearing a hard hat. She's got some sticks of dynamite she's going to blow up over here. And by disturbing the Earth somehow, here she's going to be using some dynamite, but she could alternatively wait for an earthquake to happen over here. By causing some disturbance to the Earth or waiting for one to happen naturally, and then listening with, let's say, a seismograph, which I'm just going to draw as some sort of box because I've got a clue how they work. She's going to listen for the waves that are generated by this disturbance to the Earth. And from the arrival times of these waves and their wavelengths and their other properties, she's going to work out what the internal structure of the Earth is. Both of these disturbances to the Earth will cause waves to propagate down into the interior and then get reflected back up to the surface. There'll be waves traveling along the directly along the surface. And by studying these waves in detail, she can hope to learn the internal structure of the Earth, what's going on at the boundary between the mantle and the crust, and things like that. So astroseismology, which is seismology of stars, uses the same basic principles. We rely on some process to disturb a star, usually not a stick of dynamite. It can be stochastic processes or instabilities. We allow this disturbance to propagate throughout the star and feel the structure of the star. And then we listen to these disturbances, in a sense. In fact, we observe small fluctuations in the brightness of the star, either integrated across a large range of wavelengths, or we look for small Doppler shifts in spectral lines that are the signature of surface velocities that allow us to work out what sort of waves are occurring in the star. We can measure the periods of these oscillations, and ultimately we can hope to figure out what's going on inside the star. So astroseismology is really the tool of using stellar oscillations or star quakes to peer inside stars. And this is only one of two techniques that we have for looking inside stars. The other is using neutrinos. So potentially it's of great use to astrophysicists who want to check that their models for the inside of stars are correct. So I'm going to give a sort of outline of how astroseismology works. First of all, I'm going to talk about the different types of wave that can occur inside a star. With the Earth, we have pressure waves, which are primarily longitudinal, and shear waves, which are primarily transverse. In stars, we have pressure waves as well. They're sound waves, essentially, acoustic waves. But we also have another type of wave called gravity waves. These are not gravitational waves. The gravity and gravity wave refers to the fact that the restoring force is due to buoyancy, and buoyancy comes about from a gravitational stratification. I'm also going to talk about what the sources of waves in stars are. What basically is serving as our stick of dynamite or our earthquake to excite these waves, and what those processes can tell us about the physics inside the stars. I'll briefly touch on how we listen to these waves in a bit more detail, and time permitting, I'll talk about sort of second order effects like what rotation does and things like that. So let's start out over at the left-hand side of the board, thinking about acoustic waves in stars. So these are essentially sound waves. The material in a star, or in most stars, apart from in certain extreme situations, can be treated as an ideal gas. And if we have an ideal gas, sound waves can propagate through that gas with a characteristic speed. Just given by this expression here. Gamma is the ratio of specific heats. This goes as the square root of temperature. So P and rho, of course, are the pressure and the density. So if we perturb stellar material at some location in the star, then that perturbation will cause an acoustic wave to spread out throughout the star. As this wave gets reflected at the surface of the star, and maybe by certain structural features in the interior, it'll bounce around a lot, and generally speaking, the perturbations caused by the waves going in all different directions will cancel out, unless, under certain circumstances, we're able to get constructive interference, and then we can establish a standing wave. So when we're thinking about waves in stars, acoustic waves, we usually think in terms of normal modes or standing waves, and these are often typically termed P modes or pressure modes. This global standing acoustic waves. So when we're thinking about these P modes within a star, when we're thinking in this normal mode framework, we can assume that the perturbations to any quantity throughout the star and as a function of time, so I'm going to write F prime as the perturbation to some quantity. This might be the local density, the local pressure, temperature, whatever. The perturbation to any quantity can be written, let's say we're in spherical coordinates, as some function of position, then write as F prime half a phi, times the periodic time dependence. And here, omega is the frequency of the wave. Because stars are spherically symmetric, the periodic boundary conditions that apply to standing waves mean that the angular dependence of perturbed quantities will be given by spherical harmonics. So basically, in any situation where we have spherical symmetry and a wave equation or something like Poisson's equation, we always end up with solutions that, whose angular dependence is described by spherical harmonics. So this spatial term here can be further decomposed into a radial function times a spherical harmonic. And just as a reminder, the spherical harmonics are just the products of associated Legendre polynomials in cos theta times an exponential function. The spherical harmonics depend on two quantum numbers that describe the angular dependence of the spherical harmonic. M is the azimuthal order. L, the harmonic degree. The azimuthal order M basically describes how many nodal lines we have in the azimuthal direction. There are L minus modulus of M nodes in the zonal direction. That's from the south pole to the north pole for a total of L nodal lines on the surface of the star. And just as a reminder, I mean, I'm sure we're all familiar with this. M is restricted to vary between minus L and plus L. So this is all stuff that we're familiar with from undergraduate quantum mechanics. So the identification of the angular part of the perturbations as being spherical harmonics really just comes about because we have periodic boundary conditions applied in the angular direction. So I really want to emphasize that we're looking for standing wave solutions that describe standing acoustic waves within the star. So the question is, what determines this function, the radial function? But more importantly, and this is where we really have to think about the link with observations, what determines the frequency of the perturbations?
So is omega real, or does it have a...
It can be complex in certain situations, but for the moment I want you to think of it as real, okay? So if you think of omega being real, M is obviously real because it's an integer, and you can see that these two terms together describe a wave traveling around the star with a phase velocity omega over m. Thinking about what determines this frequency, well, if we just go to the simplest possible case of a system that supports a wave, which is a wave on a stretched string, then if the string is infinite, then we can waves of any frequency on that string. However, if we restrict the string to a sort of finite extent and clamp it at both ends, then we've introduced a sort of quantization condition that means that only waves of a certain frequency are allowed on that string. In fact, the sort of quantization condition for a stretched string is that an integer number of half wavelengths must equal the length of the string. So to find out what the frequency should be for these acoustic modes within a star, we're going to use exactly the same sort of analysis. So we can sort of schematically write the quantization condition as the integral over the star of the radial wave number of the acoustic waves must be equal to some integer multiple of pi, and then I'm going to add in a fudge factor in this expression here to account for the fact that we're not necessarily thinking about situations where the waves have nodes at each end of, the center of the star on the surface. If you think of an open organ pipe, at the open end, if you're exciting a standing wave in the organ pipe, the open end is actually an antinode of the pressure perturbation rather than a node. So that sort of fudge factor is just to account for some details that will be occurring at the boundary of the star. Now the question really is, what sets the radial wave number of the waves? To find out what KR is, we need to consider the dispersion relation for these acoustic waves. So assuming that the scale of the stratification within the star, the scale over which the pressure, the density, the temperature vary, is typically large compared to the wavelength of the waves. As far as the waves are concerned, the medium looks locally sort of isotropic and homogeneous. So the waves don't really see the stratification in that limit. Well, the dispersion relation for acoustic waves in a uniform medium is just omega equals ck. The angular frequency is just the speed times the wave vector, or the modulus of the wave vector, and the speed, of course, is defined over here. If we decompose this wave vector, or rather write it in terms of radial and horizontal parts, well, we can rearrange this to find that kr is just root of k squared minus kh squared. Eliminating k, we end up with omega squared over c squared minus kh squared. So we're part of the way to finding an expression for the radial wave number, but we don't know what kh is. Here I'm going to wave hands and do an, as if by magic the answer appears. For spherical harmonics is sort of, I guess, a dimensionless value for the horizontal wave number squared is just L times L plus 1. This is the sort of familiar angular momentum term squared that crops up in quantum mechanics. So the horizontal wave number for spherical harmonics just L times L plus 1, where L of course is the harmonic degree from the expression over there. And of course we actually want a properly dimensioned wave number, so we divide by R squared. So basically what we're doing is, this is kind of like L squared, so it's kind of like the number of waves or wave crests there are around the star divided by the local stellar radius. Okay? So let's substitute that into our expression for KR. And I'm going to take the omega over c out front. Uh, And I can write an expression like this, and I can further simplify it. I'm introducing a quantity S sub L squared in this expression here, which I've just defined as this. This quantity has units of frequency squared. This is a ratio of a frequency to a frequency, so obviously dimensionless. This frequency has a name. SL is known as the Lamb frequency. And it serves as a sort of critical or cutoff frequency for acoustic waves propagating within the star. Suppose we shoot an acoustic wave into a star from the surface. Let's say we're shooting it like this. Let's shoot it like that. So we're sort of directing the wave inwards. If we for the moment neglect any variation in the sound speed, we can see that since the frequency is a global quantity, then the modulus of the wave vector, the length of the wave vector, doesn't change as the wave propagates inwards. But from this expression here, we can see as we go inwards, with the Lamb frequency increasing as we go inwards, because the radius is decreasing, we can see we're eventually going to reach a point where SL over omega, SL squared over omega squared goes to 1, and the radial wave vector goes to 0. So even though the length of the wave vector has remained constant, its radial component has dropped down to 0. So what that really means is as our wave propagates inwards, it gets bent. And in fact, it gets turned completely horizontal, and then it starts propagating outwards again. Now what's really happening is we're having a total internal reflection of the wave caused by the fact that the radial phase velocity of the wave is increasing as we go in. And we know that if we fire a wave through a medium in which the phase velocity is increasing, either smoothly or discontinuously, then there's the chance of a total internal reflection where basically we get the wave gets refracted around and ends up going back in the direction it came from. One way of thinking about it is if we draw wavefronts like this, well, on any given wavefront, this end is deeper than this end, so this end has a relatively larger radial phase velocity. So actually, the wavefront moves faster there than it does there, and the wavefront ends up getting rotated around. So this dispersion relation here tells us that any acoustic wave is going to propagate inwards until it reaches a point where the frequency of the wave is equal to the local Lamb frequency. Then it's going to get reflected around, and it's going to propagate back up to the surface. And when it hits the surface, well, here's a point where we can't really neglect the variation of the stratification, or the variation of the stellar properties with depth. The surface of a star typically has a pressure scale height, a characteristic length over which the pressure drops from large to small, of only a few hundred kilometers. And this compares with orders of magnitude greater radius. So basically, there's this thin transition there at the surface of stars, which to the wave appears as a density discontinuity. And we know that waves, when they reach density discontinuities, acoustic waves, tend to be reflected. So what happens when the wave reaches the surface of the star is that it just gets reflected back the way it came, and it goes on its merry way again towards the center until again it reaches this special line here, which is defined by the frequency equals the Lamb frequency. Remember, the Lamb frequency is increasing inwards, so it will always reach a point where the wave frequency equals the Lamb frequency and get refracted, or totally internally reflected around due to refraction, and come out again. And if you imagine, I'm going to draw the whole star. I drew this one a bit too big, but if this dotted line represents our sort of critical layer, where the wave frequency equals the Lamb frequency, then we're going to get something like this. And I kind of drew it sort of right, so that when the wave came back there, I fudged it a little bit. But when it comes back, because we've enforced periodic boundary conditions, we know there are going to be an integer number of points where the wave hits the surface and gets reflected back down again. And so we're going to get a nice standing wave forming. And if you think, if we have waves of different frequencies, well, they're going to get reflected in the interior at different depths. If we go to higher and higher frequencies, then we're going to be able to penetrate deeper and deeper into the star where the land frequency is larger.
So to what extent would this be a realistic picture, or to what extent would there be so many of these created by any real event that they would interfere with each other and kind of ruin the simple picture?
This is a... despite the simplifications that have gone into this, you can take a real stellar model and you can do a ray analysis or a normal node analysis and find, yeah, you do get...
So the nonlinear interactions between waves are just irrelevant?
They're not irrelevant, but it turns out for many of the cases we deal with wave excitation in real stars, the typical amplitudes of the waves are much smaller than the amplitudes at which you would expect any kind of nonlinear couplings to occur. So we're allowed to get away with linear perturbation theory most of the time. There are some situations where we're not, and then we have to be a lot cleverer. Because obviously, as soon as you get nonlinearities, all of this analysis kind of goes out the window.
What happens if L is large? This equivalence between the M frequency and the omega happens at the surface of the star?
For very large L's, the critical area is shifted outwards, and you end up with a very small amount of penetration allowed.
So at some point, it should be living just on the surface, right?
Yes, that's right.
And then high L's are not allowed?
No, they are allowed. But these are modes that are trapped very close to the surface. And the opposite limit, where we take L equals zero, we actually get radial modes, where there's no horizontal wave propagation, and those can penetrate all the way down to the center of the star. So at the moment, we can have waves of any frequency above some. We can have standing modes of any frequency above some threshold. There's not an upper limit to L, and there's not an upper limit to omega. That'll come out slightly clearer from the analysis that I do right now. But the fact that the waves are trapped in a very thin surface layer doesn't alter their viability. They're just sort of skin waves, I guess. Okay? Right, let's go back over to this side of the board. So with that little sort of side spiel on the land frequency, let's get back to our quantization condition. So now we know that we can eliminate the radial wave number from this equation in terms of expression involving the mode frequency, which is a constant throughout the star, the sound speed, which isn't a constant, and the land frequency, which isn't a constant either. So our quantization condition becomes some integral over the star and omega over c times the land frequency squared over the mode frequency equals pi times some integer plus our fudge factor. Now I should mention that this integer n we actually call the radial order. It counts essentially the number of nodes in the waves going from the surface of the star to however far down the wave gets. And that however far down the wave gets is that sort of critical radius that I drew with a dotted line on that diagram on the far right. And I write that as RC. And we're taking our integral, therefore, from RC, which is basically the point where this term under the square root vanishes, all the way up to the surface of the star. So now we've got to find a neat way of doing this integral. And so a bit of hand waving is going to occur here. I've got my notes to guide me through it. In this integral, over most of the integration range, the mode frequency is going to be quite a bit larger than the land frequency. So this term is going to be close to unity. And likewise, the sound speed is tends to be smaller further out in the star. So the biggest contribution to this integral comes from the sort of envelope regions of the star, the sort of outer regions where the sound speed is lower. So we can in fact approximate this integral. As basically just assuming this quantity is 1, assuming that we're taking the integral not from the critical radius, but from the center of the star, 0, out r. So we've got rid of that. Oh, I should have had a factor of omega there. But what we're going to do is we're going to introduce a correction term to take into account the fact that, well, we're not really, we shouldn't really be going from the center of the star to the surface, we should be going from this critical rate to the surface. So basically, we can write this correction term. If we assume that from the center out to the critical layer, the sound speed is approximately constant, which turns out to be quite reasonable. In the center of a star like the Sun, the sound speed doesn't vary by a huge amount. Then the correction to this term, to get a good representation of this, is just going to be given by the critical radius over the sound speed in the core. So this is basically what comes from integrating from the center to RC, and assuming C is constant. And I should have an omega term in there, I think. Now, it seems as though there's a bit of a jump going from here to here, and it certainly is. I've simplified it somewhat. One can do it with a little bit more rigor, and it turns out when one does that, you end up with a pi over 2 correction term that sort of fixes it up for us nicely. And it's going to, I have to introduce that here so I get the right result, okay? I'll leave it as an exercise for the listeners. What's useful about this expression is that the critical radius at which we transition, the quantity under the square root vanishes, we can actually express in terms of the L and the mode frequency. At the critical radius, the lambda frequency squared is equal to the mode frequency squared, so L times L plus 1 times C squared over R squared, this is going to be R critical squared equals omega squared. And then we can solve for RC. Now, under the assumption that this critical radius is quite close to the center of the star, so it's sort of round about here, then we can just take the sound speed here to be the sound speed in the core. What's nice about that is you can see we're going to cancel out the C4 there. We can also make the fudge that L times L plus 1 square root of is approximately equal to L. This is another case where if you do the analysis properly, you can actually demonstrate this is the right thing to do. But I'm giving an abbreviated cartoon version, so you're just going to have to let me get away with that one. So let's substitute our critical radius back into here. And we end up with this expression here. And recognizing that the frequency is going to cancel out in this term, we can actually move this term over to the right-hand side and then divide through by the integral over the reciprocal of the sound speed to obtain the final result, which is on the next sheet. L over 2 there. That's our fudge factor. And this expression was first developed for applications of the sun, and helioseismologists, for some reason, prefer to use the linear frequency rather than the angular frequency. So if we divide through by 2 pi, we end up with this expression here. Where delta mu is given by that. Right, so let's just take a breather and think about what we've got. Firstly, are people able to see the expression down there?
Could you tell us, is this an exact expression, or it assumes something about a dependence of speed of sound on the radius?
It's an approximate expression, one that becomes asymptotically correct for large n, so high frequency modes, because those are the ones that are going to penetrate quite far down into the star, and also for smallish l.
What do we assume about C? Because at some point you said we assume something about C. You introduced C core, but then that dropped out of the answer.
We assume that our critical radius was down in the core, and I stated that the sound speed is approximately constant in the core. That's something that comes out of stellar structure. Now, one can redo the analysis to a higher order and find that one gets correction terms that depend on the sound speed gradient in the core. And in fact, I'll get back to those correction terms in about 5 minutes, because they turn out to be important for learning about conditions deep within stars. But for the moment, let's just take a look at this expression. So it's ostensibly a very simple expression. The frequency of any standing acoustic wave, a p-mode, depends on the radial order of the p-mode, how many nodes we've got between the surface and the critical layer, the harmonic degree, which is a measure of the horizontal wave number, some fudge factor of order unity, times this delta nu, which I define here. If you think about it, delta nu is 1 over the time it takes for a sound wave to propagate to the center of the star and back again, or 1 over the sound crossing time from one side of the star to the other. So it's a global average, I guess it's a sort of global harmonic mean of the sound speed throughout the star. And this expression, introducing delta nu, which I should write up what it's called. It's called the large frequency separation. It's something that we can easily measure from observations of star oscillations. If we observe an oscillating star, and I use the sun as my sort of canonical example, we can observe modes spanning a range of n and l, and from the separation of modes that have n different by 1 or l different by 2, we can trivially measure what this large frequency separation is. And it's just 1 over the sound crossing time for the star. And that really gives us a measure of what the characteristic time scale, you could call it the free fall time scale or the dynamical time scale, explosion time scale. It's the characteristic time scale over which the star readjusts to any departures from hydrostatic equilibrium. And it depends on the mass and radius of the star. So in the case of the sun, we already got a reasonably good handle on the mass and the radius just by looking at the things that are orbiting the sun. But when we're dealing with a star that's many light years distant, if we can observe a group of periods in the light coming from the star, if the light fluctuating, we can do a Fourier analysis, pick out certain periods, and are able to see sort of uniform spacing of the frequencies, then we can identify what the large frequency separation is. And once we can get a handle on this dynamical time scale for the star and place constraints on its mass and radius, in fact, I think it's the mean density that it really gives you, because the scaling of the dynamical frequency is aborted. The gravitational constant times the mass over the radius cubed, which is the sort of measure of the mean density.
Just a very stupid question. Most of the theory you developed here seemed to have very little to do with assuming anything about a star. It's just slow gradients in the equation.
Yep. Scale.
So this is, so far, all much more general, right?
This applies to self-gravitating gaseous spheres. Now, most of us know that to be a star, but in fact, when the original theory of oscillations, stellar oscillations, was developed back in the 1900s by Kelvin, they didn't talk about stars, they talked about self-gravitating gaseous spheres.
So what's the typical value for the sun? Like what, it's a minute or a year or what?
It's about 10, about half an hour maybe. So typically, oscillations that we observe in the sun that are associated with these, that are manifestations of these acoustic waves, typically have frequencies that are some multiple of delta nu. So if the period is half an hour, then the frequencies are 2 per hour or higher. In fact, the sun, its acoustic oscillation spectrum peaks around periods of about 5 minutes.
So isn't it difficult, I mean, being such a small period, isn't it difficult to measure it because I don't know, there are lots of wildlife noise and whatever?
It turns out that, I mean, there are other signals present in the sun, you know, that are associated with convection and things like that. But because on the sun you can measure horizontal wavelengths of disturbances, you can separate out turbulent signatures from genuine or convective signatures from genuine acoustic modes. I mean, with the sun, it's...
The observations are made by observing light, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
So you have to worry about electromagnetic waves as well?
When you say electromagnetic waves...
Magneto, I don't
You do have to, you have to worry about the effects of the sun's magnetic field on the frequency of these waves, but these waves are typically, I don't think they really couple that strongly to any alphane waves or magnetosonic waves that might exist in the in the surface layers. But certainly in a global sense, the effect of the sun's magnetic field on the structure of the sun, on the size of the convection zone, does have an effect on the frequencies that we get from this sort of analysis. And you can see the frequencies, the p-mode frequencies of the sun change throughout the solar cycle.
Yeah, I mean, when one looks at one of those incredibly detailed pictures of the sun, it looks very rough and it's boiling.
Yes.
Are those the waves you're talking about?
No, they're not. That's, that sort of boiling structure is the sort of upper is reflecting the convection that's occurring beneath the sun's surface, and those are convective plumes.
How do you isolate the signals of the density?
In the case of the sun, what you have to do is take some sort of spatial Fourier transform across the sun's surface and look for patterns that have, you know, the same wave, essentially the same wavelength across the sun. I mean, basically, you project the image of the sun onto a basis set of spherical harmonics, and then you can extract out the modes with different L and different M. In the case of stars, things are much more difficult because all of the light from the star is collapsed down to a single point, into point source. But nevertheless, if you use very, very precise photometry that can pick up signals, periodic signals, with a maybe down to one part in 10 to the 6 of the star's mean brightness, And you need space-based photometry for this and long-term monitoring. You can nevertheless pick up individual frequencies. If you get enough of them, you can start playing games with this sort of formula. If you don't have enough of them, then you've got to be a little bit cleverer. And you've got to start taking those modes that you can observe, constructing a model for the star, and seeing whether that model is able to reproduce the observations. And so we take it from that approach. So in the sun, we're kind of spoiled. In stars, we're sort of challenged by the paucity of data, and we, rather than treating a whole a mass of modes together, we sort of focus on individual modes and try and do an analysis mode by mode.
Just to have a rough idea how well the theory works. As far as I understand, we should see the degenerate modes, right? And in practice, they would never come degenerate. So what's roughly the difference between delta omega divided by omega? I mean, delta nu divided by nu.
When you say degenerate, are you saying between the
n equal 1 and l equal 0 and for n equal...
Well, in fact, thank you for bringing that up, because that brings me to something called the small frequency separation. According to this formula, if we define delta nu as the spacing between a pair of modes that differ downwards by 1 in n, but upwards by 2 in l, then according to this formula, they should have exactly the same frequencies. When we observe modes in the sun, they don't. And it's those sort of departures from the expression down there that give us a handle on things like the gradient of the sound speed in the core of the sun. So this is just the sort of lowest order expression in a sort of hierarchy of expressions that one can construct. And the small frequency separation which is the sort of next highest order term in the expression for the star's eigenfrequencies, rather than giving us a handle on a global property of the star, which is just its mean density, gives us a handle on the gradient of the sound speed in the core of the sun.
So how large is delta nu divided by nu?
I think I'll have to rely on one of my colleagues to answer that. What's the difference between the large and the small?
Well, the large is 138 microhertz, the small is 10-ish microhertz.
Okay, so we're talking...
The frequencies themselves are 3,000.
Yeah. But 10 to 1 for the ratio between the large and the small separations.
10%?
Yeah.
Does your form for KH have anything to do with the fact that you have a self-gravitating body? I mean, where does the form for KH come from?
No, it's really... It doesn't depend on the self-gravitating aspect at all. It's the fact that this is just a spherically symmetric body, and so it's a mathematical result.
What's for the Earth?
Well, this analysis doesn't work for the Earth, because the Earth, fortunately, is not an ideal gas. But
you have seen
the light. I have. But in quantum theory, when one's dealing with the angular momentum an electron in a hydrogen atom, one sees L times L plus 1 as the sort of characteristic quantity, and we know that angular momentum via the de Broglie quantization rule, the hokey picture of the hydrogen atom where you have an integer number of wavelengths going around the nucleus, relating that to the angular momentum of the electron, this is the same sort of argument.
So where does the self-gravitating part come in?
Well, the self-gravitating is important to hold the thing together.
So you explained this wouldn't work for the Earth, but would it work for a gas giant?
Yes. Modulo the fact that if it has, for instance, a metallic hydrogen core, you have to put a different equation of state in it. It'll work for degenerate objects in general, but you need to change your equation of state. To reflect the fact that you're no longer dealing with an ideal gas.
Can I just add something? I've heard recently people working on Jupiter to try to detect pulsation modes in Jupiter.
Yeah, there's quite a well developed theory of oscillations in Jupiter, because it, A, it's nearby, and B, it's very rapidly rotating, which means it's a great testbed for that sort of thing. Also, it's a great testbed for degenerate equations of state, because if you think something like Jupiter, if the small frequency separation is probing what's going on in the core, then you can really test what you think the equation of state is in the core of Jupiter, whether it is metallic hydrogen or something like that. Now, just to give you an idea of what this can do to, do for you when applied to the sun, I think based on application of helioseismology to the sun, we now know the sound speed throughout the whole of the sun down to, I think, a fraction of a percent. Is that about right, Steve?
Yes. How is that possible if the error is 10%?
Well, you have many, many, many modes, and each mode is affected slightly differently by departures from this formula. So by combining together the information from all of the different modes, you can be you can get incredibly accurate or precise and accurate values for the sound speed throughout the sun.
Can I clarify in a different way? As far as I understand, our calculation was inaccurate in two ways. One way, mathematically, we just drop some corrections. We can restore them, and by making a lot of experimental measurements, we can try to fit the function C as a function of R. That part I understand. Uh-huh. But there also was a step when we said that the sun is the ideal gas, and I think that's not exactly correct because we have several different parts. We have hydrogen, we have a gas of photons, so they can interact in a complicated way. So can we estimate what's the error bar related to that?
In the particular case of the fact that, I mean, yeah, you're right, the sun is a essentially a two-fluid gas. One of the fluids is photons. But in the particular case of the sun, the ratio between gas pressure and radiation pressure, which is a representation of their relative energy densities, is, maybe I said that wrong, the radiation pressure is only in the sun, it's only a small fraction of the gas pressure. So in fact, the radiation pressure plays a very small role in the structure of the sun. Nevertheless, even though I started off by saying assume an ideal gas, when we build models for the sun, and in fact any star, we don't assume an ideal gas. We assume a gas that is made of three components, ions, electrons, and radiation, and we treat each of those as it should be treated and combine their partial pressures together. So we solve self-consistently for the ionization state of the gas, and all the different elements in the gas. The ionization state affects the electron number density and therefore the electron pressure. We've got term and equation of state for radiation pressure. So that's all taken care of. So this does not rely on ideal gas. I assume that to keep things simple. And in fact, in situations where, for instance, the radiation pressure dominates, you can get some unusual types of wave phenomena that don't really behave like normal acoustic waves. Okay, so what's the point of knowing the sound speed inside the sun to such a high degree of accuracy? Well, it allows us, so we can, I think I heard someone, what's the temperature? It allows us to know the temperatures throughout the sun, and the temperature's interconnected with the other state variables. And so it allows us to really know what the internal structure of the sun is. And we can test that, we can compare that internal structure measured empirically against models, and we can tune our models until we get a match, and then we think, well, we've got a pretty good model for the sun. And our pretty good model for the sun says that there should be this many neutrinos produced in the core by the proton-proton chain. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the solar neutrino problem, which was that models for the sun predicted a certain neutrino flux produced in the core. Measurements of this neutrino flux on Earth only found about a third of the neutrinos that they should have. Fingers were pointed in all directions, but when fingers were pointed at the people making models of the sun, they said, but the helioseismologists tell us our models are correct. Therefore, the finger should be pointed at the particle physicists. And rightly so, because this is what led to the the hypothesis, and I guess it's, I don't know whether it's more or less confirmed now, I think pretty sure it is, of neutrino oscillations and the fact that neutrinos change their flavor as they propagate out through the sun, so when they arrive at Earth, we've still got the right number of neutrinos, it's just some of them have changed into new neutrinos and tau neutrinos, and we can't detect them. So, from a field that began maybe in the acoustic oscillations in the sun were first detected in the early 1960s it was a seminal paper in 1965 by Leighton and Simon reporting on them. So, starting from sort of humble roots and just following the study of something that ostensibly has no real connection with particle physics, but just following it through to its bitter end and then discovering that, in fact, observing frequencies in the sun has immense diagnostic potential, helioseismology was actually able to make a very profound contribution to particle physics. Now, when we're applying the same techniques to distant stars, we don't have the luxury of the observational data that, of the same quality that we do in the sun. But nevertheless, we can measure things like mean densities. We can measure things like how convection is behaving in the core. We can detect things like differential rotation. Certainly, astroseismology is an incredibly potent tool to pin down fundamental properties of stars right across the galaxy that we otherwise wouldn't have a handle on. Now, time-wise, I've been going on for an hour, and I haven't even got to the other type of wave that are getting stars. Now, I could do a five-minute go-through of gravity waves, and yeah? Or are we good?
Well, there might be other questions as well. For example, what? You have measured other star mean density. Have there been any surprises?
Yes, there have. Steve will be able to tell us about some.
In 5 minutes?
There have been... I'm only familiar with a certain type of star, but these are massive luminous stars where the oscillations are not excited stochastically as they are in the sun. I haven't really had the chance to mention that in the sun, the acoustic oscillations are excited stochastically by convection just below the sun's surface. And it's just sort of sloshing material around. So these are sort of essentially transients, but in other types of stars, there are genuine instabilities that converts thermal energy typically into wave energy. So these show up if one does an analysis of a normal mode analysis of the star, these show up as complex eigenfrequencies, where the imaginary part of the eigenfrequency gives you your exponential growth rate. I study massive stars in which the instability is basically a heat engine due to a particular dependence on the transparency of the stellar material, the temperature. It turns out you can get a situation naturally arising where heat gets added to the stellar material when it's hot, when it's at a temperature maximum, and taken away from it when it's at a minimum. And this is all you need to operate a heat engine that converts heat into work. And this does the work that's done on the stellar material excites both acoustic p-modes and global gravity waves, which are known as g-modes. And these allow us to probe what's going on in the star. And one recent-ish result was the first detection of differential rotation. If rotation has an effect on pulsation frequencies, much like any kind of perturbation to a hydrogen atom, like a magnetic field, will, for instance, lift the degeneracy in M. There's no dependence on M here, but if we introduce rotation, we get a linear splitting with respect to M. But if we measure in one particular star, we measured these splittings and found that the derived rotation rates are different depending on which group of modes you look at, suggesting that since the modes are probing different parts of the star, those different parts are rotating at different rates. So that's one example from stars that I'm interested in. I'm probably not familiar enough with other fields of astrophysics or other branches of stellar astrophysics to highlight more, but. I've got loads of colleagues in this room that are sitting here grinning at me.
doing great.
Because this heat engine is very sensitive, requires a specific temperature dependence for the transparency of the stellar material, it depends on certain parts of the star having certain chemical compositions. In stars that Steve is interested in, and Stefan, to get the right composition to drive the pulsations in these stars that we observe, you have to include diffusion of elements and radiative levitation of elements in your stellar evolution models. So observations of these sorts of stars are helping to improve our understanding of how additional transport processes affect stellar structure and evolution.
I think someone should say how many stars for now they've measured delta nu's from space versus what we knew 5 years ago from the ground. What's the number?
5 years ago from the ground, you could hold them in one hand. With Kepler in particular, it's in the dozens.
So
for
delta nu's and
going thousands up quickly.
For regenerates.
I'm talking about solar type stuff. When you expand the playing field to include subgiants and giants, then the number gets in the thousands.
Yeah.
That's right.
For those of you who aren't familiar with Kepler, this is the photometric monitoring satellites that measures the brightness of stars. What's special about Kepler is it's just sitting up there looking at a couple of 100,000 stars. Its main mission is to look for the small dip in brightness caused by planetary transits in front of the star, but a sort of piggyback component of the science. Is doing astroseismology. And with uninterrupted monitoring of stars for where you're getting a brightness measurement every 30 seconds, you use that for months and months and months, and you would be staggered at the tiny signals you can pick up that come out when you do your Fourier analysis. And you don't have to worry about atmospheric absorption, you don't have to worry about the sun rising. Space is a good place to do long-term photometric monitoring.
Okay, one more. Does it make sense to ask about seismology of larger objects, say clusters of galaxies or the universe as a whole, or it doesn't make sense?
I think that's probably a little too highfalutin for a stumbled stellar astronomers, but I'm sure a cosmologist will have a shot at it.
Thank you.